G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnum.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a guest lined up for you today, and it is in fact Fox Sports' Simon Hill talking about his book, which has just been released, Gob on a Stick.
Oh, looking forward to that.
Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
And as usual, we have just two topics under discussion, either side of the interview. And we thank all of you that have been listening to the podcast previously. Also thank all of you that have supported the Johnny Famishin Statue Project. Pleased to say that they've managed to get all of the funds, and that will be unveiled now on the 20th of January in Frankston. So there will be actually a dinner on the 20th, and there will be an unveiling on the 21st of January. So if you're in and around Melbourne that time, it's during the Australian Open. If you want to get out to Frankston and see that, I know Azuma Nelson is coming over. Jeff Fenwick will be there. Obviously, Johnny Famishin will be there, so for boxing fans, it'll be a big event.
Are you going to get the opportunity to get there?
I'm going over. I'm actually emceeing the dinner the night before.
Oh, excellent. That'll be a great night.
So, yeah, it should be a good night. So, it's great that everyone who's contributed to that, try and make sure you can get there.
Can you get a photo with, Azuma Nelson standing on one side with his fist against your cheek and Jeff Fenwick standing the other side with his fist against your other cheek?
We'll see if that can be done. Anyway, I'm going to go first today.
Okay.
My topic is the decision by the ICC to have a trial of 4-day test matches if both sides agree. Now, as you know, I actually have thrown that in the ring on the show before. And it wasn't my idea. It was actually an idea that was raised by Ian Peebles, the cricket writer and former Test cricketer, who I think was one of the first Scottish-descended players to ever play for England. But anyway, he put that forward back in the 1960s because when New Zealand first started playing, they were getting pumped and the games weren't lasting the full 5 days, and he felt that that was something that should go well. I've got pros and cons with it. I don't see a problem with it. I think when those lesser nations maybe are playing the top nine teams, which is what Dave Richardson, who is the ICC chief executive, is putting forward. But I certainly don't want to see it between other nations. I think, you know, the top nine nations, if they're playing a test match, it should be 5 days. Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. I do think, again, it's when are you going to change it, though? That's the other problem. So we've now got that, who is it? Ireland have been given test status along with, who was the other nation? Bangladesh already had it. I've forgotten. Is it Kenya?
I'm not sure, actually. Might have to look that one up.
I've forgotten who it was, anyway. But I sort of think, okay, but when do you decide that, for example, they are strong enough to play a 5-day test match? And of course, the other thing you have to look at there is there's so many variables in a test match. Like the weather can be bad one day, you can have rain, you lose a day's play, so suddenly it goes to being a 3-day game or whatever. And as we've seen David Warner come out and say, you know, a test match, you have to have a certain level of fitness to last the 5 days, because you may spend 2 days in the field and there is a mental fitness, there's a physical fitness. And I just wonder, are we going to do these nations coming in that are playing 4-day tests a disservice by not making them realize that they have to get up to that level in order to perform at the highest level and compete against the top nine nations? So it's a questionable one. I'm in favor of it to a degree, as I've been saying for a long time, but I just don't know how you're going to decide when a team is ready to switch from 4 days to five. And I certainly, as I say, don't want to see the top nine teams playing against each other in a 4-day test. What I'd like to see actually come back, and this is a little bit controversial, is a rest day. I actually enjoyed the fact that there was a rest day, because that, again, in itself is very difficult to come back and replicate the pressure you had 48 hours before, and the conditions have changed as well, and it had a real bearing on the match. And if you also think the way the pitches are now so doctored towards batting sides, then I think that would make it another component that might make it a little bit more competitive again.
Certainly give the bowlers a bit of a rest, wouldn't it? Interesting idea, the 4-day test. I'm sure there'll be nations that think, oh, yeah, that's not a bad idea, we should try it out. And it'll all be going swimmingly until they need 2 wickets in the last 10 minutes of the fourth day's play to win a test game. And then they're suddenly thinking, gee, wouldn't that fifth day be handy? I'm not. I'm at a... sort of at a certain level, I'm against it. Like, I would say my default position would be no 5-day tests.
Yeah, because they're saying they're going to try and increase the number of overs played in the 4-day test so that it ends up so that it ends up being level to the 5-day. But that'll never happen. They never get the overs in a 5-day test.
Yeah, they can't get them to do it now. The over rates are appalling.
Yeah, dreadful.
Yeah, so exactly how they're going to manage, unless they start really fining these guys and taking away money and playing days, maybe that's the way, or just taking them out of test matches.
But the other thing is it going to bring in punters? Because at the end of the day, that's what really is what matters and what's driving it, is the finances and whether people will come and watch the test match. Now, they're saying a lot of tests don't last 5 days now. Well, okay, they don't last 5 days, but they're scheduled for 5 days. And let's be honest, we know why they don't last 5 days, because the players today play too much T20 and they don't know how to bat a long innings.
That's a good point. And I'm sure a lot of this, the pressure for this so-called 4-day test, comes from people like broadcasters. Because, you know, they've got to have people there, they've got to have all the setup going, associations have to make sure they've got people lined up to be there for that fifth day. And if you don't get there, what happens to those people? Do you still have to pay them? You know, I would imagine if someone contacts me a couple of weeks out and says, oh, well, here's 5 days' work and you get to day four, and they say, oh, see you later. Well, hang on a sec, mate, I've given up this day to do this.
No, you would be paid for the five, because that would be what you're contracted for. But, of course, the other thing is then they have to fill that fifth day where they've banked on having cricket all day on the air. And this is
Come on, mate. In fairness, who doesn't love the Beverly Hillbillies?
But this is one of the problems, though, John, is that a lot of the TV stations, or the ones that are dedicated sports channels, and it is amazing when there is live sport and they show repeats of games, you just go, why are you doing that? Especially when some of them have the rights to other tournaments. That one drives me mad. But the thing is, they're complaining that they've not got enough sport to put on TV. So if they lost a day's cricket, you know, they've got to fill that with something else. And what are they going to drop in that slot? I mean, look, I used to love it when they showed games from yesteryear, because it took you back down memory lane. You saw how good players were of yesteryear. You saw how the game had evolved. You saw how pitches had changed. You saw people actually wearing whites and proper cricket gear, you know.
If I ever hear a broadcaster whinge about not having much enough sport content, they'll be getting a stern email, because we've seen just very recently a broadcaster who had the rights to live sport refused to show it and plugged up rugby league games round 12 from 1996 or something, you know, when they had access and they paid the money for the rights to live sport, and they still didn't show it.
Did you find out who the second team was?
Ireland and Afghanistan.
Oh, Afghanistan, there we go.
Which is great for the Afghanis. That'd be interesting. I mean, they've come a long way in cricket too in recent times.
It'll be interesting. I'm not sure about it. As I say, I think I have no problem when they are sort of maybe playing to get started, but I think there has to be a period where you turn around and go, okay, this is just for the first 2 years. After that, you're playing 5-day test matches.
I haven't heard much from the players' point of view. I don't know if anybody's been particularly vocal about it from the players' side of things, but...
Well, Steve Smith and Dave Warner said, nah, don't like it at all. They've come out said that. And there was one of the players, I think it might have been Joe Root in the UK, was saying, you know, he wasn't keen on it either, that he liked to stick with the traditions of the game, as you would expect a Yorkshireman to say.
Yeah, you would. But I think a lot of it will come down to what the players want. I think if the players supported it, it would happen. But if they can stand staunchly and go, look, no, the primacy of Test cricket is important to us, and... If you start playing 4-day tests, I was going to say, oh, what does that do to the statistics and all that? Do you put asterisks?
Well, there you go. Yeah,
but then you look through the history of Test cricket, and there has been changes in the format. You mentioned the rest day. I can remember them playing rest days when I was a youngster.
But they were still 5-day tests.
They were.
And I mean, let's not forget that there were the other test matches were just until there was a result back in the years gone by,
and they had
to cancel that one. I think it was in South Africa that was 11th day or something.
Because
the boat was leaving and they had to stop the game. And that's when they came up with timed test matches.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of water to go under the bridge, I would think, before it actually comes about. But
well, no, it's going to happen. It's now just purely whether both the competing teams agree. That's what it's down to. So it's officially been stamped with approval by the ICC, and it is now up to the two nation bodies whether they decide they're happy to play a 4-day test rather than five.
you know what's going to come next after the four-day test? They're going to start to realise that they need a shorter form of the game, and 20 overs is far too long. We'll have 10-10 cricket. What's this fascination with making everything shorter all the time?
Well, if you remember...
They've got a short format.
I think it was the Benson and Hedges competition in the UK, and then when that goes how
long
ago?
Is that the 60-over one?
Yeah, it was the 60-over competition, and they were... But it used to be a league, so you were in little pools of, I think it was three or four teams, and then the top teams went through to the quarterfinals and then into the semis and the final. But there was what to do if there was a tie or if it was, you know... So they actually had that they put a stump in the wicket and you nominated a bowler and he had three balls to hit the stump. And the first, you know, if you hit the stump, you went through. Which to me, hey, that's still a skill, you know?
Oh, yeah. To a degree. Oh, you've got to come up with some method, don't you, in those situations. So.
Better than bloody Duckworth Lewis.
Oh, yeah. That's another podcast, the Duckworth Lewis system.
Well, just to try and explain it.
Well, what was wrong with the theory of, okay, you've only got... The other team made 200 in their 50 overs, so they went at a run rate of four. You've got to score at a run rate of four for these 32 overs that are of your innings because of rain. Four times 32, that's your score. What is wrong with that system? Does that not make sense?
Oh, it's not scientific enough.
Why do they have to throw all of these other variables and factors into it that essentially don't really, if you look at it, they don't really affect it. In the sense that you're assuming those things. Those things might not even happen.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh, statistics.
Anyway, I think that's enough on that one. We'd love your thoughts. If you want to tell us what you think about the four-day test matches, just drop us a message on Facebook or even in the comments section on notthefootyshow.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Aduka, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
I think our guest might be a big fan of Mark Viduka.
He may well be. I'm sure he has commentated plenty of games involving Mark Viduka. And we're talking about Simon Hill, the voice of football in Australia, with initially SBS and then with Fox Sports, who has just written a book about his career in broadcasting called Gob on a Stick. And I thought, having worked alongside Simon, I would catch up with him and not get him to reveal too many of the stories in the book, but we could talk about the book and also look forward to Australia's World Cup qualifiers against Honduras. Simon Hill, welcome back to Not The Footy Show.
Good to be with you, Ashley. It's been a while.
It has indeed, yeah. And there's been plenty happening, and I believe you've even actually been sitting at a computer writing your memoirs.
I don't know about memoirs. That sounds a bit grand. But, yeah, I've been writing my life story. I've been writing it for the best part of 5 or 6 years, actually. But it's an idea that had its genesis when I first started in sports journalism 26 years ago now. Blimey, that makes me feel old. I used to come home and, you know, tell my dad a few stories about what I'd seen or heard or done in my career, and my dad, being a, you know, proper Northern Englishman, used to say to me, "You should write that down, lad. You know, write a book one day. It'd be very interesting." That. Well, here we are, a quarter of a century on, and I've written it. So I'm approaching 50. So I thought it was a good time to release it. I'm the first Englishman to reach 50 this Australian summer, and I hope it won't be the last, Ash.
Absolutely, I agree with you on that one. I mean, it's they say there's a book in everybody, but I mean, it's one thing sort of saying that you've got the stories, pulling them all together, that's another thing. I mean, did you find it difficult, or was it fairly easy because you had written those notes down all those years when your dad told you to?
Well, the writing of the book was probably the easiest part. The editing was a completely different matter. That's when obviously you have to sort of knock it into some sort of a shape, and obviously you have to go through it with a fine tooth comb to make sure you're hopefully not libeling anybody. You have to readjust your thoughts and check your facts. And did I get that right? Did I remember that in the right way? And if you're not 100% sure, obviously you've either got to rework it or you've got to take it out completely. So, you know, that was the most time consuming and trickiest part of the process. But, you know, I'm fortunate that I've got a relatively good memory, which obviously is a useful tool to have as a commentator as well. So, you know, I remembered a lot of the main stories, and I've done it, you know, virtually in chronological order, so I could go back through my own archives and think, yeah, I did that on that particular year, and then that sparked a memory here and there. So, you know, hopefully overall it makes for an interesting read. I've sort of split it into two sections. Obviously, the first part of my life was, or first part of my career was spent in England, and then the second part in Australia. So, you know, hopefully there's something in there that interests people, and they will enjoy reading it. If they don't want to read it, well, they don't have to. Same as any other book.
I mean, was it always your dream to go into being a sports broadcaster once you realised you weren't going to play for Man City?
Yeah, well, that's actually the opening lines of my book. You know, I realised at the age of 12 that I was never going to be good enough to play for Man City, because the club I played for as a junior actually had a City scout come and watch us one Sunday morning, and I thought that was my big moment. And, you know, in a few years' time, I was going to be wearing the sky blue of my beloved club. And I recognised that day when he didn't pay me any interest whatsoever that that wasn't going to be a reality. So I was so in love with football, even at that age, that I reasoned I was going to have to try and find some other way to, you know, make my living from the game that I adored. So I was already heavily into, you know, listening to radio commentary in particular. You'll remember these two names, actually being an Englishman yourself. Peter Jones and Brian Butler, they were the two guys that I worship, really, on the radio, on the BBC. Brian Butler in particular was my favourite. And I think really even by the age of maybe 14, 15, I'd pretty much set my heart on being a football journalist. Although, to be fair, I didn't want to be a broadcaster. I wanted to write. That was my big passion. The broadcasting sort of I fell into rather by accident.
No, I mean, and now, of course, as you've become the voice of football in Australia, did you ever imagine that that would be the case, you know, went back in Manchester, that you'd be on the other side of the world and everyone would know your dulcet tones when it came to football?
No, I mean, obviously, I had no idea that that was going to be the way my life turned out. My initial goal was to write for a newspaper in England. You know, my ambition was probably the Daily Mirror or the Guardian, being a left-wing sort of a bloke myself. But I never really had any broadcasting ambitions or ambitions to work overseas. Probably in those days, I would have been, you know, not even cognizant of the fact that football was played at any great level in Australia. So, you know, these are the twists and turns that your career takes, and there have been a few in my broadcasting life, some unexpected, some were planned. The fact I ended up in Australia, as I explained in the book, was basically down to a friend of mine that I used to work with at the BBC, a guy by the name of Rob Minchell, who emigrated to Australia many years before I did. And he was actually working at SBS Radio, and I came over to see him on holiday, and he told me that he'd heard that there might be a vacancy as a football commentator going at SBS, and he thought I should apply for it. And this was back in 2002 when I'd just left the ITV Sport Channel. Again, the twists and turns of your career. I'd gone to the ITV Sport Channel from the BBC after 10 years with ANTI in the UK, on the promise of really a long and fruitful career at ITV. And that channel had gone bust within 12 months. So I was looking around for work, and Rob mentioned this opportunity at SBS. So I stuck in an application on spec, and to my absolute astonishment, they wrote back a week or two later and said they were interested. So you never quite know what's going to happen, good or bad. You know, it's like life itself. There are ups, there are downs. Sometimes your flavour of the month, others, you know, you're out on your ear after 12 months when you don't expect it. And you've just got to roll with the punches, really, good and bad. But I've had a pretty good run in Australia, that's for sure.
No, it's been good. And I mean, did you ever commentate Manchester City or not?
Yes, I did, on quite a few occasions, which, to be honest, I don't know if you've ever commentated Swindon Town, actually. I know they're your club. It's an odd experience, and I didn't much enjoy it, really. I always felt that going to Main Road, which it was, you know, when I was a commentator in the UK, my place, really, at that joint was in the stands. I didn't feel comfortable being in the press box. As though I somehow didn't belong there, you know, that because when you're a journalist, you're sort of an outsider and you're, you know, you're supposed to take a a back seat and view it as a neutral observer. And I found that difficult with my club. It didn't help that later on, when I covered them for ITV Sport Channel, I was actually touchline reporter, and the relationship between ITV and Man City, as I outlined in the book in that particular season that I covered them, was really fraught. Kevin Keegan fell out with ITV very early on in that season, and I sort of bore the brunt of that. And I almost fell a bit out of love with my club. It was really a very strange period in my life. So, you know, when I go back to the UK now, occasionally I have to take a press ticket if I go and watch Man City, because the game might be sold out if it's a, you know, a cup final or a big league game. But I always try whenever possible, even if I have to pay through the nose, I try and buy a seat and go and sit in the stand, because, you know, at heart, at essence, same as you, I'm sure, with Swindon, you're still a fan, even though you work in football. And, you know, City was always my club and will always be my club. So that's the way I see it. And when I go back, I want to be a fan again and just, you know, whistle and boo and cheer like everybody else.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's very, very difficult. And that's why probably in Australia, if I'm honest, I don't really support any team, so that I don't have that problem. You know, it's a very difficult one.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I mean, I don't support a team in Australia because I work in it. Now, that might sound like an oxymoron, because I did have a team in England and I worked in it. But obviously, when I arrived in Australia, the A-League didn't even exist. The NSL did, but I had to form an attachment over time to the game in Australia. I'm very, very attached to the game here now. In fact, I'm probably more evangelical about, you know, the game of football in Australia now than I am back in England, because the game in England can survive quite happily and easily without me, thank you very much. Whereas, you know, I feel as though I have a role to play, the same as everybody else in football in Australia, and we all have our little part in trying to build it into what it hopefully can be. So, you know, I'm absolutely, as I say, evangelical about the game's future here, but I don't have that club connection, which in some ways is a little more tricky, but in others makes it a bit easier.
Yeah, I'm sure if I remember hearing Martin Tyler asked once, you know, how he would feel if he had to commentate England winning the World Cup. And he goes, well, I've done that many World Cups and they haven't got close yet. So I'll tell you when they get to that stage. But
that's true.
I can imagine. I mean, again, and I know I felt like this, having sort of covered Australia for a long time and then, you know, gone to places like the Solomon Islands when they qualified for Germany. It was a special moment. And I'm sure even for you at the moment, when you do all the Socceroos games, you feel a part of that journey and how important it is, because it is very important, the Socceroos.
You know, when I first did the Socceroos, actually, and I've been fortunate enough to call the Socceroos well over 100 times, which makes me very blessed. And I remember Paul Williams, my predecessor at SBS, before my first game, which was Venezuela against the Socceroos in January 2004, I think. And he sent me a lovely text message saying, good luck today, enjoy the game. I always used to think that calling the Socceroos was the biggest privilege for a football commentator in Australia, and I always tried to treat it with the reverence that it deserved. And I always thought he was absolutely right, and I've always tried to remember those words before I call an international game, because I think they're very prescient. You know, the national team of Australia in football terms in this country, it usurps everything else. The A-League has become hugely important and always will be, but for me, the national team is still the flag bearer, the rainmaker, the connector of all those people who might have a passing interest in the game but don't necessarily go and watch it every week. So there's an extra responsibility, not on the shoulders of the players and the coach, but also on, you know, the behalf of the broadcasters, to try and do it well and do it right. So I always try and remember those words, and I thought they were pretty much spot on.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And I must admit, when I've called them in, you know, hockey tournaments, it's a privilege always to do any international.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, looking at the World Cup this time around, it's been a tough old journey. And do you think they can get to Russia?
Oh, I mean, they can. There's no doubt about that. So I think if you look at the two squads, Honduras and Australia, I still feel, and I might be a little bit biased in this regard, but man for man, Australia is a better team. But it's one thing having it on paper and saying it, it's quite another going out and proving it. And I've thought that quite a few times during this qualifying campaign, that Australia had the edge man for man, but they haven't been able to get the results they needed. It has been a road that's been strewn with potholes, and who knows what's to come in Honduras, because, you know, that away leg is going to be very, very tough. I think it's, you know, similar to Uruguay 05. It's going to be hot. It's going to be humid. It's going to be hostile. Goodness knows what the pitch will be like. You know, Honduras will be physical. They've got their whole nation behind. They're a football mad nation. I think it only comes second to Catholicism in that part of the world. So, you know, the Socceroos have got a big fight on their hands, in the away leg in particular. And the only thing I hope is that when we come back to Sydney for the second leg, and this, as you know, actually, this isn't always the case with sports fans in Australia, that the home fans recognise the enormity of the occasion and they make it as intimidating for Honduras as it will be for our lads over there in Central America. That's the task of the supporters in the stands for the second leg.
No, I agree with you. I remember in 2005 when the Australian crowd booed the Uruguayan national anthem.
Yeah.
You knew then, you went, wow, I've never seen this in Australia, and we are going to make this a cauldron and really make it difficult.
You know, actually, there's a brilliant moment, and again, I recount the story in the book, on the SBS coverage, when the anthems play and you barely hear a bar of the Uruguayan anthem, and at the end of it, you remember Jorge Fossati, who was the Uruguayan coach. He had these big bulging eyes that were almost popping out of his skull, and he looked around the stands as if he was a tiger in a cage, and he wasn't expecting that. He wasn't expecting Australia to be unfriendly hosts because of what he'd heard of the country, maybe what he'd experienced before. And at that moment, I thought, brilliant. The fans know what's needed here. And the Uruguayans have got a little bit spooked by that, even though they actually played well in that second leg and they could have nicked it, but they didn't. And maybe that was that little 1% that got the Socceroos over the line. And we need it again on the 11th.
Yeah, I mean, you're right as well about Honduras, because, I mean, they went to war over a qualifier, didn't they, years ago? 6 days war, I think it lasted.
Yes, with El Salvador.
That's right, yeah.
A disputed World Cup qualifier, and passions were raised, and there was so much disrespect show between the two teams that they actually, you know, they took up arms and went to war with each other. It only lasted a week, but... yeah, wow. Fancy going to war over a game of football. I mean, I love it, but let's simmer down here. It's only a sport.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you should tell it. The name of your book is Gob on a Stick, and I mean, hopefully no one's going to go to war with you over your revelations in that, but is it on sale at all good bookshops?
And as the old saying goes, Ash, I believe that it will be, certainly if it's not today, then within the next 24 hours, on sale at all good bookstores, or if you want to get it online, New Holland Publishers, they're the people who've been gracious enough to print my book, so they do have a website, you can go and pay for it online.
And are you going to be doing any signings when you come over this side of the country?
If asked, if required, I'm happy to sign anybody's book if they've got a copy. Next time I'm over at a Perth Glory game, I don't know when that is actually, but if anybody wants to bring their book to the stadium and seek me out, I'll be happy to sit my paw on it if they want to.
Well, Simon, always good to catch up, and wish you all the best with the book and also guiding the Socceroos home over the next few weeks.
Thanks, Ash. We'll do our best, mate.
Hi, I'm Chris Sorello from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show, and that was Simon Hill, the football commentator from Fox Sports, and his book sounds as if it'll be a very interesting read. Obviously, a few people in there that he's sort of been not sat on the fence with in terms of his opinions. And I think that's always good when you read a book. You just don't want to read platitudes non-stop for 250 pages. You want to hear what actually went on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I must admit, when it comes to not just the commentary of the match game, but the game in general, I like the way Simon thinks. He obviously doesn't necessarily toe the line that a lot of other media commentators in this country do when it comes to football.
I was amazed actually talking to Simon off air about how similar our paths into broadcasting were, in that, you know, he wanted to get into a work on a newspaper and wanted to get involved as a copywriter and all of that. And that's actually how I got into newspapers, was I couldn't get kept applying for jobs, couldn't get them, and in the end went in as a copywriter. And then it kind of evolved from there. So it was very interesting how our paths were actually quite similar.
And in fact, I heard Simon interviewed the other day about the upcoming FFA, FIFA stoush that's going on, and he made some very interesting points.
Well, I think he's one of the few journalists in the country, to be fair. I think Michael Lynch and Simon Hill would be the two who have admitted that Frank Lowy did some good things for the sport. We can't deny that. But overall, he also did a lot of things that have not been good for football. And as you know, I've questioned Frank Lowy's autonomy that was given to him since very early in the piece as well. I think he was given far too loose a rein, and he had weak board members around him who didn't actually question some of the decisions that were made. And I know there are a lot of people with blinkers on that think Frank Lowy was the game's saviour. I look at it now, 10 years or 11 years down since they took over the reins of football, and I'm not sure he is quite the knight in shining armour that a lot of people would like to have you believe.
Was it the Crawford Report?
Was the one that came before, yeah.
Yeah, you had the Crawford Report, and then, okay, we're going to form the FFA, we're going to form the A-League, and it's a whole new world for Australian football, and everything's going to be rosy, and we're wonderful. And 10 years later, we find ourselves basically back to the position of before the Crawford Report.
Because a lot of the suggestions that were put forward by David Crawford in the report have been ignored. And the other thing, if you look at it on a local level, which really gets my goat, is that the people running the game here... So to me, the board are meant to oversee the governance of the game. They're meant to make sure that it's in a safe position. But the board here are not interested in making sure, for example, that the standing committees and the zone reps, who have the voting power to put the board into power and also to take them out of power, they're not listening to them, and they're not making sure that those things, the representatives there, are elected properly, and that there are minutes kept of all their meetings, and that they're actually communicating with the clubs that they represent. You take as an example at the moment this whole FFA extraordinary general meeting and voting on the restructure of the board structure of the FFA. Football West haven't even revealed to anybody how they're voting. We all know how they're voting in favour of whatever the FFA puts forward. But again, the zone reps and the standing committee people, who are meant to represent the football community here, should have been the ones who are actually telling the board how to vote. It should not be the board just making that decision off their own bat. That is what Crawford wanted, and that's how the game was meant to be run. And this is where it's gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Well, to think that 10 years down the track, FIFA have to come back in and make the threats that they do after football had its revolution, but it was once again a revolution in the sense of something going round and round and round and being the same, not a revolution in the sense of change happening. So,
well, that's probably a discussion for another day, or we could go on for a while.
I think when that situation comes to some sort of resolution, as opposed to revolution, then I'm sure we're going to be having a chat about it. If it comes to a resolution.
I'm sure we are.
Now, just quickly before we move on, we heard Chris Sorello there at the end of the Simon Hill interview there. Chris was one of the sponsors for you to get, his Chris Sorello training, for you to get up to Sultan of Johor to do the English language broadcast, the under-21s tournament up there. And from the entire hockey community, can I thank you and the efforts you put in. What you did was real excellent. The coverage was phenomenal. And what showed it up in even better light was the lack of the FIH's ability to get other hockey broadcasts. We've got the Asian Women's Cup going on at the moment. Can't see it. It's not even been broadcast in Japan. You can't see it live at all. There's no highlights packages. There's nothing. Now, that's the Confederation Cup, and they couldn't get their act together to broadcast that. But you and a couple of your mates who dug into their pockets provided hockey with this wonderful visual spectacular that was the Sultan of Johor. Well done to everybody involved. The camera work was fantastic. It was really good. And FIH, take note. Please take note. It can be done, and it can be done cheaply.
Yeah, I mean, look, thanks for that, John. I think the thing was, I wanted to prove that it could be done and that you don't have to spend hundreds and thousands of dollars to do it if you want to cover. And let's be honest, it's an under-21 tournament. People would say, oh, there's not that many people interested. Well, the viewing figures at the moment are close to 100,000 already, and it's not even a week since the tournament was over. So, you know, we had really good feedback. I know that Chris Sorello, the first day those adverts ran for his coaching academy, his dad was getting calls and inquiries. So it was great for him to actually get that response as well. I know that Mercy and Hockey were very happy with that. Also, Curtin University in Malaysia, who were the others who came on board. And, you know, it was a case of just trying to say, look, we can do this. We can show it. I must thank the Johor Hockey Association because they actually paid our airfares and our accommodation up there and organized the lift. So that was the main thing was they said, look, we'll cover those costs if you can bring in to cover the other costs, which I'll be negotiating with them on that for next year now that we've had the success of that. But it was great to have some companies see, have the vision that I had that we could make this work and we could actually put something out there that was good and promote these young players because they are the future stars.
And what was really good too, I mean, Curtin University, well done for them to step up. But Simon Mason and Mercy and Chris Sorello and his dad, you know, it's hockey people who are going to be the ones that support hockey through these sorts of things, you know, and we've got so many resources and so many people in our game willing to step up and do these sorts of things. It's just that they need some sort of guidance or approval, for want of a better term, from the FIH, and we're just not getting it.
I must mention one other sponsor, Axis Plumbing, who
they
do all the major projects. They're not like your domestic plumbers. They've done the plumbing at the new Perth Stadium, at the new Fiona Stanley Hospital, Wembley Shopping Centre in London, and they've got offices in the USA, Thailand, UK, Australia, and I can't remember, New Zealand, I think. Hopefully I've remembered them all.
So when hockey people support hockey, we can get great things done. Now, let's move on. We've had the Rugby League World Cup start here in Australia, and you've been away, so you probably haven't caught much of it. Couple of things. Well, firstly, the Scottish guys, they've got tartan shorts. They look like boxer shorts, boys. You look like you're running around in your underwear. I know you're big, strong men, and you'll probably squeeze my head between your thumb and forefinger and make it go pop, but really, you've got to do something about those shorts. They're shocking. But let's move on to what I wanted to talk about, and that's qualification. For players, national qualification for players. Rugby league is in a situation where it is, despite what you might think if you live on the east coast of Australia, very much a minnow sport at a global level. There's no doubt about that. And one of the struggles they face is making themselves relevant at a bigger scale than just a little pocket of northeast England and the east coast of Australia. And it's been interesting to see the way the attitude they've taken towards qualification for representative honours. We've had a situation where a player who'd played for Australia, has played a full international test for Australia, has been picked in the Australian team, and 3 days after he's been picked in that team, and only a couple of days before the tournament starts, he announces he's going to go and play for another country. Now, in any other sport, you couldn't do that. It's just impossible. The rules don't allow you to do that. I'm not sure what rules rugby league applies to qualification for international sport. Now, I understand their position. They need to make it appear as if it's a global game. We've got Lebanon playing. I'm not sure how many of those guys were even born in Lebanon, let alone have lived in Lebanon. They did fantastic to beat the French in their opening game, and it's great to see them. They're a good story. They feel good and all that sort of stuff. But can a sport do that? Can a sport have such an open slather for representative honours and still survive? Or is it just make it such a mess for them that it means nothing in the end? You know, guys are going to swap between country as it suits them, you know. Jared Haynes playing for Fiji. Jared Haynes is an Australian representative player. How could he be now playing for Fiji? I understand their position as far as wanting to make it appear global, but you've got to have some sanctity about these things.
So are those players now going to be allowed to come back and play for the Kangaroos or not?
Well, I don't know. Well, there's not a World Cup next year. There'll be a test against the Kiwis, and if they're in good enough form, I bet they will be turning out in an Australian jersey.
Yeah, you see, to me, then that shouldn't be happening. I think that, as you say, it blurs the lines.
It does.
You can't do it that way. I mean, maybe then 3 years down the track, if they've now, after the World Cup, they've pledged their allegiance back to Australia, they have to serve a period of residency or a qualification period. But you can't just switch year to year.
Look, and we've we've on this program often complained about the IRB, the International Rugby Board's attitude towards the Minnow Nations of the South Pacific area, and that their players will be poached by other countries, their players will be not released by club sides to go and play in major international events for their nations, and it's been to the detriment of international rugby that's happened, very much so. And rugby league will get a march on them because you've certainly got a Tonga team and a Samoa team that are capable of winning the tournament. They've got very good sides now because they've said, oh, look, go and play for them. We need some competition. We don't just want it to be Australia and New Zealand at the end of the day winning the tournament.
But let's be fair, I think rugby league have been quite clever in that they've seen the mess that the Australian Rugby Union is in, the mess that Super Rugby is in, and the timing of this World Cup could not have been better. I also think they've been very clever how they've been taking the games all around Australia, in that we've got games coming up in Perth. They've also taken games to Papua New Guinea. So they've really made it an Oceania tournament. And then the other thing, which to me I think is excellent as well, is the way they've tacked on the Women's World Cup onto it as well. So it then becomes, you know, a dual sex tournament. The focus is there for men, for women. And they really are going to get media attention because of all of those things, because they are taking it to a broader spectrum than just playing, say, for example, like the Asia Cup. I mean, Australia had a great chance then. Didn't play any games in Perth, did they? Let's just keep it on the East Coast. And if you remember, I've still got sitting in my email files at home an email from somebody at the FFA saying when they were putting the bid in, I said, you didn't bring anybody to Perth. Does that mean we're not getting any games? Oh, you'll have teams having their camps in Perth. And there may well be one game. And of course, neither happened. They never had any intention of doing it. And this is where, you know, I think the FFA and the AIU let down the sport as a whole. And I take my hat off, though, to the NRL or whoever. I mean, let's be honest, they're the host nation and they're the ones who are putting it together, Australian Rugby League. And I think they've done a good job. I don't agree with the qualification. Yeah. But if you look at it in the context of growing the game and what they're trying to do and making it a sort of, viable is the wrong word, but a legitimate competition where any teams can compete with Australia and New Zealand, because let's be honest, it's likely to be, or Great Britain, it's likely to be, you know, a Great Britain-Australia final, maybe the Kiwis, but more than likely it'll be Kangaroos versus the Brits.
I understand also a lot of these kids coming from Ireland and nations are coming here for opportunity, or New Zealand. They're going there for opportunity, and if they're good enough, the pressure on them to drop their heritage and just take up as an Aussie or as a Kiwi has always been big. You know, we've always got, oh, he's a good player, we're going to get him in our side and make sure he plays for us. We don't want him running around for Samoa or Fiji or something.
Well, Lottie Takiri, I remember, is a prime example. I remember talking to him when he was here with the Wallabies, and he said, you know, to play Super Rugby, he had to turn his back on Fiji. Yeah. And he goes, I would never have done that. He goes, but I wanted to play Super Rugby. And he goes, so I was left with no choice. He goes, but I would never have turned my back on Fiji. I would have preferred to play for Fiji at a Rugby World Cup than for the Wallabies. And yeah. I mean, let's be honest, he got through to a World Cup final.
Yeah.
And the classic thing was they brought out in the UK and England a commemorative mug with the Rugby World Cup final, with England winning it, and it had to be recalled twice because they spelt Lottie Takiri's name wrong twice. A bit of trivia there anyway.
But, you know, at least Rugby League are trying to protect, they understand that those nations are wonderful nurseries for their sport, and they're trying to protect the sanctity of representing those countries. And I think maybe in the future the Australian selectors should start taking responsibility for that and going, you know what? That guy is Fijian, he's a very good player, but rugby needs him to be playing for Fiji, not for Australia. And maybe it's got to take some of that thinking in rugby union as well. Rugby union's got to start considering that, you know, importing players to cover up holes in your own junior development is not a long-term fixed solution. And that's what's happening.
Isn't Australia realising that now?
Oh, when was the last time any thought process went through St. Leonard's that was forward thinking? Honestly, they make decisions and then don't worry about consequences, and then later on down the line when the consequences arise, they wash their hands of them.
Can I just go off track slightly, just on something you've said there? Because leading up to the test match here in Perth, Alan Jones, who we all know is former coach of the Wallabies and now is a big star on the radio and is very quick to have a go at people. He's been having a go at the ARU quite viciously. He stood up at the Netherlands long lunch and said in the Barbarians game that he was going to be coaching, that all the players were going to wear the Western Force socks in protest about the Western Force being axed. Now, at the time, I thought, what a fool coming out and actually saying that you're going to do that, because I don't agree with it, because the tradition of the Barbarians is that they always get to choose the club socks they can play. So anyone that's invited to play for the Barbarians can wear the socks of the club that they want to wear. So they can, if it was the junior club they played for, they can wear those socks. So I thought, A, I don't think you should be enforcing that. It breaks the tradition of the Barbarians. But also coming out and saying it before the match, and this was, like, let's be honest, about 6 weeks,
weeks before
the game. So people knew you were going to do it, so they were probably going to step in and stop it. And if you look, he made this promise, stood there, said they were going to do it. It was actually covered in the papers that the Force were going to be represented there. If you looked at the game, didn't wear them,
didn't
did they?
Happen.
No.
Yeah, well, it's...
Has anyone picked him up on that?
Well, it's very easy to say the right things in front of a hometown crowd, isn't it? I mean, it's classic politics speech. That's what politicians do. Anyway.
Well, that's probably enough for this podcast. We've covered quite a bit more than we were intending, but hopefully you've enjoyed it, and hopefully you'll be back for the next one.
It's been great, Ash. Cheers.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.